Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 68, recorded September 5th, 2012. Dick DiBartolo. Triangulation is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation, a great chance for me to pick and choose the most interesting people on the internet and in technology and talk to them, find out what makes them tick, get their great thinking. To me, this is more a hobby than a show, and apparently to advertisers as well. So it's working out really well that way. Today, you know, one of the real challenges doing a network like TWiT is finding talent. And today we're going to audition a new young talent that I have high hopes for. I think that he could go very far. He's a funny man. He's got a, you know, a great sense of humor, a big-ass mustache. And so we thought we'd have him on Triangulation this week. Give him a chance to show his stuff on the TWiT Network. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mad Magazine's maddest writer, Dick DiBartolo.
Hi, Leo.
Are you nervous, Dick?
I'm a little nervous. But I'll do my best.
Can you capitalize the B on the DiBartolo there? Because he doesn't want to be confused with the guy who does the football team. Dick DiBartolo is the host. In fact, one of our longest-running shows. Running. It's had three different names. It was originally the Daily Gizwiz. Then we realized that's too much. So we did the weekly Daily Gizwiz. That is too much as well. So we've just cut it right down to the Gizwiz. Dickie D, you know, this is great to get a chance to sit down and actually interview you.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever actually done it in this format.
No.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot, I think you've shared a lot of yourself, on the Gizwiz, and you do some stuff on the network to fill time when I'm not in the mood, and you do the Giz Fizz Saturdays after the radio show and stuff. So there's a lot of people who have had a chance to get to know you over the years, as I feel very
and they still watch
amazingly.
Yeah, I know, that's the great thing about the fans.
One of the things that first things I did to research this interview, and I've been spending weeks preparing for it, is get this book, Good Days and Mad. This is your memoir. You call it a hysterical tour behind the scenes at Mad Magazine. When did you write this?
You know, it goes back. Gaines died in 1992.
Yeah.
And this agent was after me for like 2 years. I told him, I said, you know, I like to write paperback books where they're little chapters and they can be funny. I said, I don't want to write a book. And we had three or four lunches, and he would ask me about Bill, and I would tell him all these weird stories about Bill. And then finally at one lunch, he said, you know, if you ever wrote a book about Bill, that would really keep his memory alive.
Oh, he knew how to pull your strings.
Leo, that is exactly right. I said, okay, that is it. I'm in.
And Bill's widow, Annie Gaines, writes the introduction to this.
Yeah. Actually, the funny thing is, once the book was sold, the publisher said, who do you think should do the foreword? And I said, you know, probably Annie Gaines. And I said, oh, you know, probably Mort Drucker. And, oh, no, wait, Nick Meglin found me. Oh, wait, the editor. And then I suddenly said, you know what? It can the book be like crazy, like mad? And the guy said, it's your book. I said, how about 20 forwards?
So you've got Annie Gaines, Nick Meglin, John Ficarra, who's still editor at Mad, right?
He's still editor, exactly.
Lenny Brenner, Mort Drucker, who could forget Mort Drucker's amazing illustrations. Al Jaffe, who does the fold-out in the back.
The fold-ins, right?
Fold-in, pardon me. Yeah.
Yeah.
The fold-outs at Playboy, the fold-ins in Mad Magazine. Yep. Just a ton of people here. Sergio Aragonés, who did Spy versus Spy. Jack Davis, Frank Jacobs.
Yeah, so it was 24 pages I didn't have to write.
You know, I think that was the real reason.
Yeah, right. If I knew you back then, you would have written a phone.
No way. So let's start at the beginning. We might as well. Okay. You were just a kid. I think knowing you now as I do, I think that there's something a little wrong with you.
Okay. This is a very good way to start an interview.
I think there was something wrong with you as a kid. You're not normal. Everything is a little twisted. Am I right? I think so.
No, yeah, I agree with that in a way. I really kind of live in a semi-fantasy world. Uh-huh. And thanks to Twit, one of my fantasies is a reality. No, I'm serious. In my father finished the basement. We lived in a house in Brooklyn. It was an attached house, but the whole house was ours. And we had a basement. My father paneled it and everything. And I went down there, and on the wall it said RDB Studios. And I had a microphone, and I could broadcast to the lady next door. And
no kidding. RDB's Richard D. Bartolo.
Yes, Richard D. Bartolo. I had stationery made, Richard D. Bartolo Studios.
You're kidding. So no. you're like Robert De Niro in that movie with Jerry Lewis, where he's the crazy guy who's doing a show in his basement.
Yes, exactly. Again, I had a little spotlight, and I bought an EV
you're
microphone.
Kidding.
No, an EV microphone that Lafayette Radio was like $30, and back then that was like a lot of money. And so I pretended, yes, that I was a...
Did you have a transmitter? I mean, did you have any way to for anybody?
No. The only time I transmitted, and it was a childish prank, but it was fun. I hit a speaker out in the hedges in the front of my our house. And I would hide in the garage. We had a garage under the house. And I had the microphone hooked up to an amplifier that fed the speaker. And someone would pull up and park, and I would go, "That is a no loading zone." Guy would get out of his car and go, "Look around. Where's this voice from? No loading zone, please." I would just talk to people going by. And so I would transmit to people one at a time. So, you know,
how old were you when you were doing this?
Boy, I guess I was probably 14 or 15.
So, and
because I also had the other half of the basement was my trains.
You had trains even back then.
Oh, Lionel trains. Yes.
So that was your thing. You would go in the basement after school. Were you a good student?
I was a fairly good student. You know, it's very funny, Leo. There was one, and it's closed now. There was one business high school in New York City called Central Commercial. And my father owned a machine shop. And my father said, you know, "You're going to be part of the business." And I said, "Oh, you know, I don't want to weld and I don't want to cut metal." And he goes, "No, you're going to run the business. You must learn accounting."
Oh, wow.
So I read about this high school where you could take business courses as part of a high school curriculum. So I went there, and the neat thing about it was no one wanted to be in charge of the school newspaper. No one wanted to run the auditorium. No one wanted to do any of those things because the school was 80% girls, because not a lot of guys wanted to learn shorthand. So basically, I learned very little shorthand, but I put on all the shows, ran all the audio video things. It was great. It was great.
So you show business was something you really loved from day one.
Really loved, yeah. I did. I even tried out for High School of Performing Arts, but I went over there. I just went over there once, Leo, and just seeing the people there, I felt, oh, this is like a cutthroat.
Well, that's the movie Fame was about, the High School of
Performing
Arts.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I was stupid as a kid. I would buy the New York Times and look under M's to see if anybody was advertising for an MC.
Did you get any jobs as an MC?
No, I said, where did I get MCs from?
There's no jobs.
They're never listed.
So you were you? Would you say you were kind of an innocent kid?
Yeah, you know, I was good. I was good in school because I you know, my father was a tyrant, so I had to get good marks.
Was he a first generation Italian?
Yeah, he came over from Sicily, and
Your mom too?
My mother was born in Brooklyn, but my grandmother was born in Sicily. So, you know, pretty Italian family through and through.
Yeah.
And so my father, you know, my father's feeling was, if you're not working with tools, if you're not working with metal, you know, he said, writer? Are you kidding me? That is not an occupation.
He wanted
a pencil. It's not an occupation.
And I remember you told me once that he did iron scroll work and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yes, he did some of his stuff. My older brother told me some of my stuff is still in Grand Central Station.
Wow.
He made the little fancy handles that hold the brass rails in place.
Wow.
And evidently the rails have been replaced from over the years, but the little grab rails that go on them evidently still his. Yeah, so he did ornamental bronze was
wow.
what his business card said.
A trade he learned in Sicily.
In Sicily, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So did you, now as a kid, you're interested in being on the radio. Did you have influences? Did you watch any particular shows? Was there somebody?
You know what? I used to, there was an MC in the morning named Ted Brown on, I think maybe WNEW. And he was just a silly, crazy announcer. And I just wrote him a letter and I said, you know, would you ever consider buying jokes? And he said, well, you know, send me jokes and we'll talk about it. So I sent him some jokes and he bought them.
Wow.
And he said, you know, if you want to write stuff every week or every month, I'm interested. And so then he started saying, you know, come down the station if you want. So almost every other Saturday, I would get up and go to the radio station. And, you know, he would be like you, just ad-lib stuff, play records. And when I was there, he would throw in jokes I had written. So I really was, you know, I got like an early start in thinking how much fun it is to hear your material done by someone else and to really, really heard over the radio and not just someone in my driveway.
No, it's interesting.
And that just wanted me to do more.
Because that's exactly how Woody Allen started as well. He was a kid and he'd write gags for a small amount of money.
No, yeah, you know, we talked about Phyllis Diller on the Giz Whiz, and I was writing Match Game, and she was on the show and said, you know, I know you work for Med, you want to write for me? And it was $5, incredibly cheap. But the thing is,
and she was a big star, so that's
yes. The thing is, even John Ficarra, the editor of Mad, said, "Dick, you got five, I got three." But we all wanted to write for Phyllis Diller. You know, I mean, I didn't write; it wasn't a career. I probably sent her five batches of stuff, and she probably bought maybe 30 jokes out of 100. But I could say, oh, yeah, I wrote for Phyllis Diller. Yeah.
So you're writing for Ted Brown. He's on WNEW. You're getting,
yep.
And this is what, you're 12, 13, 14?
No, I was probably, I'm going to say I was 15 when I first saw Ted Brown some stuff.
Did it come easy to you writing gags? I mean, was that something you?
Yeah, it was. And I think it's probably, I'm not quite sure where it starts. You know, it's to the point where it's very hard for me to sit through a serious film and be impacted by it because there's a different movie going on in my head.
You're writing gags right from the minute.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, if I go to a very sad movie, I know to sit in the back row against the wall. Because what he should have said is, you know.
So it's in there. There's something in your mind.
There's something in there, yes.
The jokes and were you a funny kid in school? I mean, were you making jokes in school?
You know what? I was a funny kid in that Central Commercial High School because no one else was. and also the other thing was I was very good at picking up what teachers did. And one year I had to take shorthand. I didn't have to take it, but I thought, you know, hey, shorthand is going to be great because on the train and stuff, I would think of jokes or,
you know, yeah.
And I figured, you know, with a little slip of paper, I could just jot down jokes in shorthand. So I took a year of shorthand, and I noticed the teacher would read a long letter, and we would write it down, and then she would pick a student to read the letter back. But I could see that she would look down, and one day I noticed she was reading a book, and all she was listening for is the student to stop, to pause, because they couldn't get over what they were reading. So when she called on me, I would just start. I would say, dear Mr. Brown, we are in receipt of your letter. And I would see her eyes move down to her book. I said, we're in receipt of your letter, and we've decided that we're going to come to your office, take all our clothes, and we'll be walking around naked, and they will be... Right.
Now, and did then the other kids laugh? Did they do anything?
The kids, they were pretty good at stifling their laughing. But if she would call on me, everybody would nudge each other like, this is going to be good.
She's right. reading.
Yes, yes. And then I was very cunning. And then, like, I would say, oh, Miss, I can't remember her name. Miss Jensen, the third paragraph, does that start with, we are here? We are shipping you a new box. Is that how that starts? And she would look up and she said, yes, it does. Oh, thank you. And make up another. So I had a lot of fun in school.
When do you remember any of the jokes that you sold to Ted Brown, or any of those early jokes?
Well, you know, I don't. I you know, they were all one-liners. I can't even think of one.
Were they kind of cornball, you think?
Or? Yeah, you know, I think, and I'm not even sure how I phrase it. I said to Phyllis, you know, Phyllis, how about some sort of a joke about there's so much grease in my oven that when I bake, there's just room for a cup to make a cupcake. And she said, oh, that's good. That's I'll use that. Write that down. Right. So she liked all that. She liked stuff.
Was so bad that.
Yes. And anything about her being a crappy housekeeper and stuff.
Now, so you're living at home, you're in high school, and for some reason you got an idea. Had you been to submit something to Mad Magazine?
Well, you know what? I started reading Mad and was finding it funny. And then after a while, I thought, you know, I don't want to read this. I want to write this.
I want to do this. Yeah.
So I went to the library and I said, you know, I want to submit material to a magazine. Is there a book that tells you how to do that? And she said, yes. It's called The Writer's Yearbook. I think it's still published.
Oh, yeah, The Writer's Guide. Yeah, The Writer's Guide.
The Writer's Guide, yes,
yeah.
Okay. Write it.
Yeah. They still publish that, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember reading that some magazines will only accept from an agent, and some magazines will accept from anybody. And at the back of the book, I believe all the magazines were in there, and it said that Mad will read unsolicited material, but it must be accompanied by a self-addressed stamped envelope, or rejects will just be trashed. So I figured, I'll try. So I wrote what I thought was funny for Mad, and I did my own big envelope, and I mailed it off. And like 6 weeks later, I got back my own envelope, and I was just heartbroken. Oh. And I think I put it in the desk. But then later I thought, you know, maybe they'll say it's almost good. So I opened the envelope, and the envelope just has cardboard in it. And scribbled on the cardboard, it says, ha, 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 thought this envelope contained your own script. Well, we bought it, and stapled to this cardboard is $100, a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah.
And please call us because we want to talk to you about writing more stuff.
Can you get John over my shoulder? Do you have a camera? Because in your book, Good Days and Mad, Dick, you reproduce this.
Yes, because only because I could have. I mean, I was ecstatic that, and also it was so Mad-like.
And but really. Please call us about future work.
Yes.
You're 16 years old. This is like the best. This is gold. $100 and they want more.
And they want more. Yeah. I should put that up next to my George Lucas letter. I mean, literally, that did change my life.
Sure. Yeah. By the way, this is, I think, Dick, do you still have copies of this?
I still have it on my website.
Gizwiz.biz. You can buy it. And I think the proceeds go to benefit Dick's favorite charity, Pets Charity.
Me.
You. Okay, you would be good.
I had a falling out with a dog shelter. Evidently, they were not doing what they what they started out doing. So I'm shifting. I still do stuff, but with a different shelter now.
So Dick used to give the proceeds to the dog shelter until he turned out they were sons of bitches. And then and now he just keeps the money, which is, I think, perfectly appropriate. So this is great. This is a memoir of your days at Mad Magazine.
Yeah,
but I love it that you saved this because that is the best rejection that wasn't a rejection.
And, you know, Bill, you know, there's a lot of Bill in you and in Twit, because Bill's whole philosophy was that that corporations really were just terrible to creative people.
Yeah.
And I remember I was sitting in with an interview with him. Sometimes he would say, can you sit in on this interview? He hated to do interviews. And
what, just to keep him company?
Yeah, and to just say something.
Lighten it up.
Bill liked to laugh. He just liked to laugh. Even on 60 Minutes, you know, we were all on 60 Minutes. And Morley Safer said to Bill, what about ads? And Bill said, well, you know, you can take money from Coca-Cola and then make fun of them. And I said, Bill, why don't we just take money then from Pepsi-Cola? He just liked. And then
there were no ads in Mad Magazine until recently.
Not at all in the beginning.
Yeah.
They were actually, Bill told me very early on, he tried some ads, and then people wrote in and said, oh, now you won't satirize the people who advertise.
Right.
So in the following issue, he did an ad and then a satire on the ad, and people wrote in and said, oh, now you're giving them twice the space.
You can't win.
So I decided no ads.
So when did you first meet Bill Gaines?
I met him at a dinner. I was so terrified of Bill.
He was the founder and editor-in-chief.
The founder, publisher of Mad, and, you know, a hero in my eyes. Oh, yeah. And one day I called Nick Meglin. I said, Nick, you know, I didn't get paid for the last piece. And Bill said, Nick said, oh, I'll give you Bill. And I said, no, not Bill. I said, just give me a check.
Yeah, right.
And Nick said, there are no secretaries. I said, I don't want to talk to Bill. And next thing I hear is a phone pickup, and I hear a muffled voice say, DiBartolo. Who the hell wants to talk to DiBartolo? I am shaking. And I say, Bill, I didn't want to talk to you. I'm so sorry. I didn't. And Bill breaks out laughing. I'm only kidding. This is how we operate here. We act mean, but we're not.
Oh.
And then we all went to a Mad dinner, and Bill happened to say the Elephant Hotel. And I said, oh, you mean Lucy? And like Bill said, you know about Lucy, the Elephant Hotel? And I said, yeah, in Coney Island. And he said, do you know there's another elephant in Margate? And I said, I didn't. And he said, are you free Saturday? I said, yes. He said, we're going to see Lucy the Elephant. And it's a building in the shape of an elephant. I still think they're at lucytheelephantmaybe.org. And we got there, and the elephant was falling apart. And Bill says, let's go find the mayor. We have to start a fund to get this thing repaired. So we went. We found the mayor. Bill gave him a check. He said he'll contribute more money. So he started a fund to save Lucy the elephant.
He was kind of crazy about these kind of strange buildings.
Billy was very nutty about that kind of thing. We went to Lakehurst because he wanted to see where the Hindenburg had landed.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
It didn't land, you know. It landed in pieces.
Well, actually, it landed a few times.
LucyTheElephant.org is, it's amazing. It's gigantic.
Yeah. That's the small one. That Lucy in Margate.
This is in Margate, yeah.
Was tall.
So it's still there. He kept it still, he kept it going. That's really cool. Yeah. That's really cool.
And now Bill is just, you know, he liked to do incredible, wonderful things. He once, on a Saturday, told 12 of us to just mark the date, and he wouldn't tell us anymore. And the day before, he said, go to Penn Station at 8 in the morning. We do all this. I said, Billy, come on, what's going on? He said, it's a surprise. You don't ask any questions. They announced a Metroliner to Boston. He tells the 12 of us, go down to the track. Do not get on the Metroliner. No one knows, you know, is he freaking out? What is this? And suddenly we hear a train whistle, and out of the tunnel comes a switch engine pushing an 1890s restored observation car Pullman train with three waiters on the platform. And Billy says, this is your surprise. They're hooking this up to the Metroliner. We're having a champagne breakfast. We're going to Boston. I'm staying on the train. You guys have 4 hours to sightsee. And then they're going to hook this up to the 7:30 Metroliner home. And we're going to have another horrendously wonderful, all wine-inclusive dinner. He did this just mainly because he knew I love trains, and for other people who expressed interest in trains.
It sounds like he was a very generous
guy. He was a sweetheart. I mean, that Monday I said, Pilly, what in God's name does it cost to rent a train? And he said, oh, you know, I'll tell you. He said, you have to pay 30 first class fares, and you have to pay $5,000 for the car, the coach.
Wow.
And he said it was probably $10,000 for the day. I said, Billy, that is the most astounding day of my year.
So but Matt was very successful. He, he was doing okay.
He was doing very well.
Yeah.
And you know, when Warner Brothers bought Mad, they bought it with the intention that Bill would publish it for 3 years. But it was so successful that they just kept extending it and extending it and extending it. And Billy told me, I said, what's corporate world like? And he said, you go there once a year. All you have to say is Mad made more money than last year. And then they say, goodbye. We'll see you in a year.
I doubt it's that way anymore, but he could pull that off.
Yeah, he could.
Yeah.
He could.
Yeah. Did he work at Mad until he passed away, or did he retire?
Until he died. Yeah.
He never retired.
He read all the mail. He knew everything about Mad. And during that interview, the interviewer said, you know, you really are a genius. And Bill said, no, I am not a genius. The artists and writers are the geniuses. However, if there's any quality that I have that adds to the magazine, is I know how to create the atmosphere in which writers and artists can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And he was dead on about that. He was just the best.
I think that is a probably undervalued type of person, but the person who makes it possible for creatives to work,
yes,
and do what they love. That is such an important person. Here's a great pic. Is this a Mort Drucker illustration?
No, I think that's Angelo Torres, I think.
Very funny of you and Bill arguing over your contract. He was a kind of a hefty fellow, wasn't he?
Bill was very big and always on a yo-yo diet. And one day he asked me to get something out of his closet, and I went in there. And I came back and I said, Billy, you have 30 suits. They're all the exact same suit. And he goes, they're the exact same material. They're every conceivable size. I said, there are boxes of shoes. He said, when I find a pair of shoes I like, I buy at least a dozen pair, because when they wear out, they may not be available again. So if I like something, I buy a lot of them or it, so I always have it.
And Bill loved you. Bill loved you. Here's a note that he wrote to you. You were concerned about staff cuts one day, and he wrote this note that says, Dick, you'll be one of the last to go. And he stamps the date.
He did. Because Warner merged with Time magazine, and we were under, I forgot, under what umbrella we were, but we got moved over to Time magazine. And I said, how is that going to affect us? And he said, the way this corporation works, it'll take Time magazine 3 years to realize that we're a part of their division. The next 3 years, they want nothing to do with us. So you're safe for 6 years. And if you're worried about your job, you'll be the last to go. I said, could I have that in writing? Get a pad, write it down, I'll sign it. So he did.
I love it. He finally did run ads in a Mad magazine. He says, an important announcement from the publisher. It's gotten so expensive, we have to run ads. These are the ads.
Okay. I said, Bill, Hal and I came up with it, and Billy said, oh, let's do it. And it's fireworks and guns.
Make big bucks. Sell burglar alarms to your neighbors.
Right. Right.
And abdominal then snow job. Sleep away fat diet. These are the fake ads.
And over on the side, it says, don't worry, the ads will be tasteful and chosen by a blue ribbon panel of experts.
And here they are.
And then they are the packet.
Did you do a variety of different stuff, Matt? I know you did a lot of movie parodies.
I did a lot of movie and TV satires. I did a lot of ads. I think one of my funniest ads, and John Ficarra said that they're going to run it again, is called Stop at the Sneezing. And it was the side effects to watch out for is that it could speed up your heart, slow down your heart, make your heart go backwards, and in rare cases, make your heart act as a second liver. Then take 2 pills every 4 hours. If that doesn't work, take 4 pills every 2 hours or 8 pills every 1 hour. If you can drive a nail into your head with a 2x4 and not feel a tingling sensation, you may want to reduce the dosage. Just bizarre stuff, but I love writing that. Sometimes I write it and it's so silly, I just sit there and laugh as I'm writing it.
You enjoy it that much. That's awesome.
I do. Yeah.
We're talking to Dick DiBartolo, Mad's maddest writer. Now in your fourth decade, almost, maybe fifth?
Yeah, Leo, Sam Viviano called me in the other day, and he said, you know, from the day we bought your first piece to now, it is 50 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
50 years. Yeah. And for a long time, you had a streak going. Do you still have the streak going?
Yeah, it's probably 415 consecutive issues.
Never missed an issue. There was always something by Dick DiBartolo.
It could be a Fondolini or, like in the current issue, 7 pages, but always something. It's always something, isn't it?
You know, and when I first met Dick, and I've told the story many times, we were at Tech TV doing the screensavers, and a producer came in and said, some guy does gadget reviews, and he wants to be on the show. His name is Dick DiBartolo. And I said, what? Not Dick DiBartolo. I said, yeah, you know him? I said, not from Mad Magazine, Dick DiBartolo. I said, yeah. I said, are you kidding? Because I grew up reading you and the usual cast of idiots.
Yeah, usual gang of idiots.
Usual gang of idiots, yeah. And of course, Dick is Mad's maddest writer. And so it was such a I was just as nervous probably as you were meeting Bill, meeting you for the first time. And we've become great friends. And so I'm just it's such an honor. You're now learning of this.
No, all I remember was writing screensavers and saying I was coming out. Could I see the show? And I emailed you and Martin Sargent, and Martin Sargent said, he called me, and he said, you know, I know you are from Mad. Leo will never, ever see your email. He said, I'll pass it on to the producers in case they want to do anything, but you're certainly welcome. And then you made that comment, and they said, well, instead of coming to see the show, bring some crazy gadgets. ABC had sent me out to go to the gourmet show.
Ah.
So I bought some gourmet gadgets, and you and I, that was the first time I met you on air, and we just had the best time. Oh. Yeah.
I love you. Part of it is because I really, my sense of humor was formed by you and Mad Magazine growing up. I vividly remember, you know, gathering my change and bringing it to the drugstore. Please have a mat. It was 35 cents. Cheap, I remember. Cheap. We're going to take a break, come back with more with Dick DiBartolo. I want to talk. There's much more to talk about. I don't know if we're going to. We're going to probably run out of time. We've got to talk about the match game, how he saved the match game, and Dick today and all of that stuff. But first, a word from Audible.com. We're big fans, as you know, of Audible.
Yes.
Yes. Probably, do you ever listen to audiobooks or no? Probably not.
You know what? I listen to audiobooks only on the airplane. I'm not like you that you seem to listen to them at night.
I listen at home. I go home and listen. In fact, I was listening last night to a new Richard Dawkins book, which I just am a big fan of his, called The Magic of Reality. Audible, to me, I don't. You know, somebody tweeted me saying, you keep calling it reading. It's not reading. Well, I don't know what you call it. It's a book. It's, of course, somebody has read it out loud. But it's the same words that you would read if you read it on the page, pouring into your head. I don't know how that's different from reading. In fact, in my opinion, it's better than reading because there's something about having somebody read it to you. At least for me, I'm very auditory.
Yeah, focused. Yes.
I can absorb it. And my son, who's dyslexic, I think you're a little dyslexic, Dick, because you flip stuff around.
A little bit.
He has a hard time reading, and he just loves audio.
A bit a little.
So the best readers who really bring these books to life, 100,000 plus titles. I'm always nervous about talking too much about this because I know that people have limited listening time, and once they discover audio books from audible.com, we're going to lose them forever. But, you know, I'll take the chance. How about this one? The Art of Procrastination, A Guide to Effective Dawdling, Lollygagging, and Postponing, or Getting Things Done by Putting Them Off. This is my book. I'm going to...
But you'll listen to it next week.
I'm not going to buy it right now. I'll get it next time, yeah. That's the only problem with that book. If you want to get that book or any of the 100,000-plus books, any of the one-credit books for free, you can. We've got a deal. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Go to that website. You'll be signing up for the gold account. This is good for new members only. That's a book a month, but your first month's free, your first book's free. And you can cancel at any time, pay nothing, but still keep the book. Plays on everything, on all the phones, on all the portable devices. They've got a great Android app that I just love. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. By the way, if you go back to that shot, John, because if you look at those books, most of those books are books that we have recommended at one time or another on our shows. Well, except for 50 Shades of Grey. I have not recommended that one yet. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulations. Now we've recommended 50 Shades. We've even played a little bit of it on the show. So we're talking with Mad Magazine's maddest writer, Dick DiBartolo. 5 decades of writing for Mad Magazine without missing an issue. He's also our very favorite Giz Whiz. He's a gadget hound and does the daily, weekly. No, now it's just the Giz Whiz show on our network every Tuesday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. And we just really...
4 p.m. my time.
Right. What did I say?
3.
It's not. Oh, yeah. It's at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's us.
You know, they just roll me out, put me, turn on the camera. They say talk. I talk. Then they roll me back into my cave. So you, I didn't know that. See, this, I thought I knew everything about you. I had no idea that you sat in a basement with a microphone pretending to do radio shows.
Oh, yeah. Yes. In RDB Studios.
In RDB Studio. So now, we've done over 1,300 Leo, years.
My studio here is a dream come true to tell you. You know, it just
look
is.
At this. This is the real deal, man. You got to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have little Klieg lights. And I do. I have Bond doors. I have it all, pal.
Now, while you're writing for Mad Magazine, you also got the chance to write for the Match Game. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, after school, I got a job as an office boy for a game show company called Barry Enright. And Barry Enright was producing game shows. And there was they had a show called Winky Dink and You.
Yes.
Okay.
Not an auspicious name, but okay.
Yeah, yes, yes. So it was a kid show, and I heard the two Barry and Enright saying, well, Phil Kaufman's leaving. Who's going to write Winky Dink? And we need someone. We need another writer because someone write. So I've seen enough old movies to know how to get someone's attention. So I went home and I wrote a script and I recorded it on my Revere tape recorder.
Came in handy now, see?
Yeah, yeah. And I brought it into the office, and Dan and Barry had lunch together every day, and I just played it very, very loud outside their office, the desk nearest their office, and they came out and said, what the hell is that? And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I was just listening to this thing I made, and I didn't. And I said, no, wait a minute, do that, play that thing again. And I said, oh, you know, that's funny. I said, well, do you know what? We have an opening at Winky Dink. I said, really? But they were very cheap. They said, you want to write Winky Dink? And I said, yeah. They said, okay, you still have to be the office boy.
We got that's how much their commitment is to this show.
Yes, exactly. But you give you an extra $50 a week, which was more than I made as office boy, if you'll write some Winky Dink scripts.
Winky Dink and Me. So how long did you write that? This is Jack Barry. Jack Barry's the host of this, which is...
Yeah, it didn't last long. And then NBC bought Barry Enright. And so I went over to NBC where they hired me to work on Concentration, which was a game show. Meanwhile, one of the guys from Barry Enright, Bob Noah, went over to Goodson Todman. And he called me up and he said, Dick, Goodson has this new show called The Match Game, and they want to talk to you about it. Can you come over in your lunch hour? So when I went over there and explained the game, we need all these questions, to which there are no specific answers, like name a red flower, name an animal that lays eggs, name an animal that has fur. And he said, could you write them? And I said, yeah. And he says, this is the problem. Goodson thinks the show could be a hit. He's really worried that there's not enough questions. They want to hire you 5 months before it goes on the air to come up with about 2,000 questions. I said, yeah, I'm up for that. I can do that. So they hired me, and I started writing Match Game. And I kept writing, and it was a year-long contract. And about 11 months in or 10 months in, Goodson called me in and said, you know, it's the contract has not been renewed, and so it's going to be canceled. And you have 4 or 5 weeks of shows to go to tape. But I'm just telling you now that when that ends, you're out of a job. And I'm just telling you this so you can keep your eyes and ears open. And so over the weekend, I was thinking about it. And on Monday, I went back and I said, you know, Mark, I work for Mad Magazine, and instead of doing name a red flower and name something you serve with an egg, how about silly questions? He said, like, what? I said, how about Mary likes to pour gravy on John's blank, which was the first Match Game question ever. And so Goodson laughs, too, and he says, oh, people are going to laugh. But what will they say?
Yeah, it's sexy. Mark,
yeah, they're going to say,
you know,
potatoes, meatloaf. they're gonna go for the dirty thing. He said, well, you know what, it's canceled, so they can't cancel it twice, just do what you feel like. So I started writing those. And
now, what year was this? Was this the late 60s?
Match Game went on in 1962.
And was it Gene Rayburn in the early days?
Yes, it was. It went on New Year's Eve of 1960, I guess New Year's Day of 1962.
I wonder if I can find some of those old.
Yeah, and yes, it was with Rayburn.
And who are the Match Game? As I remember, you had two real people participating, and then there were three or four celebrities. Yes,
that's exactly right. Well, no, the original Match Game was everybody was on one level, Rayburn and the contestants. It was two celebrities. And each celebrity had two regular panelists.
Okay.
And that was the show.
And then it became two rows of celebrities. They added more celebrities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, with the funny things, Goodson called me in and said, you know what, the ratings are going up, and they're picking the show up again and again and again. And then he said, you know.
So the sexy worked.
Oh, big time.
Here's the pilot episode. Can you get audio out of this? Here's the pilot. with the music that I remember so well.
Safari. From New York City, NBC TV presents The Match Game.
Was it Burt Bacharach?
This portion brought to you today by the makers of new decongestant bromoquinine, a medication that gives you fast, effective, big relief for big cold miseries. And now here's your host, Gene Raver.
This is the pilot episode. So this is probably with the stupid questions.
Yes.
He always had the worst microphone. I don't know what the hell that is.
Oh, it's a lavalier with a plastic holder.
He didn't want to wear a microphone. He wanted to carry it.
He wanted to carry it. He went out into the audience a lot.
Ah. Now, where did he come from?
Rayburn was on a show here called Rayburn and Finch, which was two cut-up disc jockeys in the morning.
So he was a DJ, radio DJ.
He was a DJ, yeah. Exactly.
And
they auditioned him, and I think he started out on a different show called Tic-Tac-Doe.
Oh, well, that survived many years.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And then
so this is the original format. So Peggy Cass, who ended up being on it for a long time, and then there's two normal people on either side of her.
Well, wait a minute. Now you're looking at
Arthur Trudeau, Peggy Cass, and Ronnie Smith. I think these are normal people, right?
Right. No.
Those are celebrities.
I think this is to tell the truth.
Oh, no! It says pilot episode.
You know what? Yeah. I forgot that I thought the desks met at the middle.
It was a long time ago.
It was.
So, how many writers were there on the Match Game?
In New York City, me.
That just you?
Yeah. And then it ran like 7 years in New York. And then Goodson said, Dick, we're going to do a syndicated version and we're going to retool it. And it's going to have six celebrities and we're moving it to California. I said, Mark, Mad is here and my boats are here. And I'm a native New Yorker. I don't want to go to California.
I can't imagine you in California.
He said, Dick, as long as there is a Match Game, you'll have a paycheck. So don't, he said, you live where you want. And he said, besides, I'm not closing my Park Avenue offices. So you stay here and just send the stuff out.
So you'd mail them out to them?
Oh, they had something called the Daily Pouch. So I would just run up to the office. I mean, they gave me a beautiful corner office in the Seagram building. It was really nice.
How many?
They treated me really well.
Did this pay well? I mean, how many questions did you have to write a day?
You know, I would write 40 or 50 a week.
But it was a paying gig.
Oh, yeah. It paid very nice. It was paid very nice. Especially since Goodson said, you know, the show couldn't exist without you. I wish they'd given me like 0.5% of the show. Then I'd be like a multimillionaire. But I gave myself 18 years of employment. So,
wow. Long time. Yeah. So yeah. You worked right through into the 70s. Because I remember Match Game, was it 76? When they got color and
yes. Yeah. And then they stopped calling it, putting a year on it, because they realized, hey, if we're going to syndicate these, we don't want years on right. these.
This is the 10-year-old Match Game.
Let's stop doing that. Yeah. So they did. While they were retooling it, I went over and worked on To Tell the Truth, and then I worked on What's My Line.
You actually appeared on To Tell the Truth, I think.
I did appear on To Tell the Truth when Rayburn was a contestant. What was a celebrity panelist on the show?
And was Bill Gaines on it, or?
Bill Gaines was one of the mystery. Yes, Bill Gaines was, my name is Bill Gaines, my name is Bill Gaines. Which of these three people is the real William M. Gaines?
And I guess his face wasn't well enough known that at the time.
No, and Bill dressed like a slob. And so no one got him. And he was just thrilled by that.
He fooled them all. And there he is. There's Bill Gaines. And he fooled them all. I love the beard. And then those days, that long hair, that was very radical.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And now at the end, do you show up at the end on this? Or
in the credits, I am walking around. And then Gary says to Bill, someone on the staff claims to work from Ed Magazine, and Dick DeBartolo, and Bill said, I never, ever heard of him. But, you see, can you go back like a few frames?
Yeah, I saw you very briefly.
There,
if I scroll right, back right there on the left,
there
right?
I am, all the way to the left.
That's you behind that card.
Behind that card, and Rayburn is holding it.
That's pre-mustache.
Pre-mustache and wearing a jacket.
Dressed nice. Yeah. I wish we had a better picture of this, but we don't, unfortunately. Wow, Dick, and you're wearing a suit. Look at that.
I guess I was.
Yeah. So when did... Oh, there you are. There he is with Gene Rayburn, and Gene's holding a card up because...
I think it says Match Game Writer.
Yeah.
I think it's... Yeah.
That is hysterical. There's Dick DiBartolo. A long time ago. You look like somebody out of Mad Men.
Yes.
There it is. Special material.
Do.
Yeah.
Dude. Oh, you know what? This is called the mill around, where everybody who's on the show.
Yeah.
Right.
They do this on Saturday Night Live still.
Yeah. Well,
this stuff never dies.
I know. I said to, I think it was Bruno Zarata producing it. I said, you know what? Let's send someone out every day of the week to mill around who wasn't on the show.
Just some guy.
We'll send him out Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And on Friday, let's bring out three people and say, I milled around with you. And we made him talk to each celebrity each time.
But they didn't remember.
No one remembered. And then we said, oh, you don't remember him? Kitty, this is him talking to you. Bill, this is him talking to
How
you.
How embarrassing.
Well, you know, they were anxious to either go to lunch or run to their dressing room and change clothes, especially the women, because there was just a 10-minute break between shifts.
Right. They didn't have a whole lot of time. The mill around simulated that this was a cocktail party, but really, they couldn't wait to get off stage and change so they could just have a little break in between shows.
Yes, exactly.
They do one day, they do a whole week of shows.
Yeah, yeah, five shows in one day.
So you saved Match Game. 18 years you wrote for Match Game and Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
And all this time you got the boats.
Got the boats going, working for a boating magazine called Power Boat.
When did the gadgets come in?
You know what? I always liked gadgets, and my office was full of all kinds of weird stuff. I just bought gadgets, you know, like Jamma B, who had that Sony thing.
That Sony, that's right.
Yeah. You know, like the first Sony Walkman. I had to have the first Sony Walkman, or the first Sony CD portable player. And Barbara Griff, who was working on To Tell the Truth, left Goodson Todman, went over to, back then it was Metro Media, Channel 5. And she was doing a two-hour show called Saturday Morning Live. And it was a show where they had a chef and a carpenter and a pet guy and a gardener. And it was a service show to tell you how to do things. And she called one day and she said, you know, you have all those gadgets in your office. Would you ever just come on and show gadgets? I said, oh, yeah, okay. Is it a funny thing? She said, you have to impart information, but we don't care how crazy you are. Just so I got gadgets in the office and I went there. And she called me a week later. She said, you know, we got a lot of mail that people want to know more about these gadgets. You have more. And I said, Barbara, I have more. So she said, well, why don't you just be part of the show? So I did. And then I got a call from Regis, Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. And they said, are you exclusive on that show? And I said, no. And they say, can you do gadgets for Regis? So so that started a whole third career.
A whole third career. So you were with Regis and Kathy Lee until Kathy Lee left.
Exactly. Yeah.
For quite a while. You still do ABC World News Now, the overnight.
Yeah. When Kathy Lee left, I had a friend over at World News Now, and he said, you know, are you a late night person? I said, am I? And they said, you know, we're looking for a gadget person on the overnight news. And I said, boy, I'm really interested. And they said, you know, we like will tape your spots at midnight.
But it's late.
I'm in. Because as you know, Regis, you have to be there like at 7:30 in the morning.
And you're a night owl.
I'm a night owl. Midnight is like afternoon for me, so we still tape spots around 11:30 or midnight, but I love it.
I've done it myself, and it's kind of weird. You go in there and it's empty, there's nobody there.
It's very quiet.
In fact, I remember it was before Peter Jennings had passed away. He was still anchor of the ABC News,
And we went. I looked at his chair.
Yes, fits. Yes. It's the Sunday. Normally, they. I don't know back when you did it. Now they just do the pre-tapes on Sunday nights, because now that studio is Nightline, Diane Sawyer.
Everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody uses that studio, so you go in real late at night before the news goes live at 2 a.m.
And I think actually one night I had the guy's keyboard. Remember that? It was a keyboard for people to know
yes,
to type.
Oh, yes, that was.
And the producer said, oh, Peter's going to love this. And he dragged me down to Peter's office and said, Peter, look at this. Peter Jennings, look at this. And Peter Jennings is going to, that's nice. That's great. That's great. But that's how I got to meet Peter Jennings.
Yes, yes. That was the most that was the guy who said that men hunt and peck.
Right.
And so if it's just an alphabetical order,
they'll be better.
They'll do much better.
Yeah. Yeah. So bringing us up to the present, you just got married.
I just got married. I have a long-term partner of 32 years, Dennis Wunderlin. And we got married about 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Here in New York City. Thank you.
That's really sweet. That's really nice. When, how did you meet Dennis 32 years ago?
You know what? It's very funny. We both worked out at New York Health and Racket Club. And, you know, you see people at the gym. You're like, oh, hi. And it was 1980. And some local station had called Bill and asked about Alfred for president. And Bill called me and said, they want to do something, Alfred for president. What should I tell him? I said, tell him that his campaign manager is available to be on the air. So Bill said, you want to meet his campaign manager? So they sent a crew up, and, you know, I just winged it. The guy said, tell me about his platform. I said, oh, his platform is amazing. It's plywood, but it's marine.
It's very well and constructed.
Said, it's 4x8, so anybody can stand on it. You know, so I just winged it. So anyway, a few days later at the gym, Dennis said, oh, my God, I saw you on television.
You're Alfred Newman's campaign manager.
You're in politics. I didn't know. So we started talking, and then he said, well, let's have lunch one day. And here it is 32 years
later. That's amazing. And Dennis is a graphics designer.
A graphic artist.
Does he have a sense of humor?
Dennis has a great – Dennis is wildly shy but has a tremendous sense of humor.
Oh, that's great.
And you know, we
he'd have to.
Yeah, we both love Turner Classic Movies, and we have an awful lot in
you
common.
Laugh a lot, I'm sure.
The only thing is, he's not crazy about gadgets.
What?
Yeah, I know, it's very strange. Very strange.
Well, that relationship is doomed.
Yeah. I give it another 32 years, and then
that's
I'm
it. You know, I can't tell you how wonderful it is to work with you every week, Dick. And I'm glad we could take a little time and just kind of get to know each other a little bit better.
No, I'll compliment you because you have a great sense of humor, and you kind of know where I'm going with things. I mean, I think once in all the years we've done the Daily Gizwiz, which is about 7.5 years
long time.
Now.
1,300 some episodes.
Yeah. After he said, I don't know where you were going with that. I said, well, I was lost too.
Mostly, but I just tried to get out of the way of the Dick train. Because
normally, you just are, you're in there. And that is just great to have somebody on that wavelength.
Well, we love doing the show, and it's it's an honor knowing Magazine's Maddest Writer. So thank
you. I'm sure.
Thank you for joining us. Dick DiVitolo. Go to his website, gizwiz.biz. There's still copies of the book, and really a great read with lots of mementos and pictures. It really is. If you're a Mad Magazine fan as I am, this is a must have book for the history of Mad Magazine. And Dick DiVitolo, you talk about Match Game and other things in here.
Yeah, all that stuff.
And there's plenty of other good stuff to do on the site. It's really quite entertaining. Dickie D, thank you. I'll see you Saturday.
I'll be here.